My royal lords and fair ladies. The children squealed with glee. It was one of their jokes when Hui addressed them that way. Today I have a special treat for you. And again pandemonium broke out. Hui's treats were usually something special indeed. What is it? Emilce demanded breathlessly. This evening you will meet the Oracle of Opet, Hui announced. And the uproar subsided swiftly. The small ones, not understanding, but nonetheless infected by the solemnity of their elders. The bigger children had heard of the Oracle. Their nurses often frightened them into obedience with the name. Now that they were about to meet this mythical creature, the atmosphere was charged with tension. They were all of them suffering from an onset of the creeps and ghostlies. Anna spoke for all of them when she asked in a very subdued voice, "She won't eat us, will she?" When Tanith came, she seated herself amongst them and threw the hood of her cloak back from her face. She smiled at the children and said softly, "I'm going to tell you a story." The smile and the promise were enough to ease the tension, and they edged in closer to her. It's the story of the marriage of the great god Baal to the goddess Astarte. Tanith began the tale from religious mythology, which was the basis of the Festival of the Fruitful Earth, a festival celebrated every 5 years. This year of Opet, 538, was the 106th ceremony since the founding of the city, and the following day would begin the festivities that would last for 10 days. Tanith held her young audience enthralled, speaking in the compelling voice which Hui had trained so carefully, using the mannerisms and gestures he had taught her. Hui watched her with an unusual mixture of professional appraisal and the adulation of a besotted lover. In 2 years, she had lost the last traces of gawkiness and uncertainty, and although she was not yet 20 years of age, there was an inner calm, a serenity of mind and expression that befitted her role of serious and occult advisor to a nation. No matter that her pronouncements were carefully coached and rehearsed by Hui Ben Ammon, it was she that made the delivery, and made it convincingly. Much of Hui's material success in the last 2 years stemmed from the questions and requests for guidance addressed to Tanith by the rich merchants and trading syndicates of Opet, and Tanith's replies. The supplicants were usually well satisfied with Tanith's advice, though it was always couched in terms of ambiguity to ensure against recriminations. Did it matter that Hui Ben Ammon was also well satisfied? In the same way, Hui, despite the loss of the king's ear, kept a guiding hand on the rudder of the ship of state. Hui was certain that Lannan Hyrcanus was fully aware of the ultimate source of the advice and guidance which he received from Tanith. In any event, Lannan visited the oracle regularly in her shrine in the grotto beside the silent green pool of Astarte. On the morrow, Lannan's visit to the oracle would be his first official act that would signal the commencement of the Festival of the Fruitful Earth. This was the true reason why Hui had summoned Tanith to his residence. He must brief her carefully on the replies she would make to the king's queries. Hui knew with a high degree of accuracy what these would be, for his informers were close to the king, and again Hui guessed that Lannan intentionally leaked his questions in advance, certain that they would reach Hui and that the replies would come through the oracle. Thinking of Lannan always brought on a mood of deep melancholy. 2 years, Hui had been without solace of Lannan's smile and handclasp and companionship, and during that time the sharp edge of his loss had not blunted but grown keener. He would wait for hours for a passing glimpse of his old friend. He would pester others for accounts of the banquets at the palace to which he was not invited. On each anniversary of the king's birth, and also on his throne day, Hui had composed a sonnet and sent it with a handsome gift to the palace. The gift had been unacknowledged, and the sonnet unsung, as far as he knew. Hui tore himself out of this sad mood and looked instead at his love. The children had crowded her now, silent and big-eyed and intent. 4-year-old Hannibal, named after his illustrious ancestor, had crawled into Tanith's lap and was sucking his thumb as he stared up into her face. Tanith's mask of solemnity had slipped a little. With these children she was childlike, her expression animated and her voice excited. Seeing her thus seemed to add a new dimension to Hui's feelings for her, and his heart swelled in his chest until it seemed that his chest must burst. How much longer must he wait, he wondered, and for what? If it had taken 2 long, carefully planned years to win her confidence, how much longer to win her heart? And having won it, what could he hope for? For she was dedicated to the goddess, and could never belong to mortal man. Tanith's story ended, and the children exclaimed and clamored for more, beseeching her with demands and entreaties and bribery kisses. But Hui feigned outrage and scolded them, while they laughed and clapped their hands with delight. He shouted for the nursemaids, and they came. Among them, that tall, brooding, fiery woman who always made Hui feel disquiet when she looked at him from those unfathomably dark eyes. He said to her, "Selene, darkness falls. Tell Timon to carry a lamp for you to the palace gate." And she acknowledged him with an inclination of the head, showing no gratitude at the order, nor resentment either. After the children had gone, they ate the evening meal, the three of them, Tanith, Hui, and Aina, the ancient priestess who was Tanith's chaperone. Hui had selected her for 2 very good reasons. She was half-blind and completely deaf. Hui had tested her by making obscene gestures at her from a range of 20 paces. Aina had shown no reaction, nor had she when Hui crept up behind her and shouted a rude name in her ear. She was just the type of chaperone that Hui wanted. They ate with the lamps trimmed low and the food served by one of the ancient slaves. And when they were finished, Hui led Tanith up the outstaired staircase to the roof, and they sat together below the parapet on reed mats and leather cushions. The night wind off the lake was cool, and the stars very yellow and bright. Hui crouched over his lute and strummed softly the rippling tune which he had trained Tanith's unconscious mind to accept as the signal for hypnotic concentration. Before he had finished the last bars of the tune, she was breathing slowly and evenly, her body still, and her eyes dark green and unseeing. While his fingers ran over the strings of the instrument, repeating the tune again and again, Hui began to speak. He kept his voice at a monotonous sing-song tone, speaking softly but insidiously, and Tanith sat in the starlight and listened with an inner ear. On the first day of the 106th Festival of the Fruitful Earth, Lannan Hyrcanus, the 47th Grey Lion of Opit, went in procession to the Temple of Astarte to take the oracle. He passed through the enclosure of the Temple of Baal, where the sacred towers pointed to the sun, guarded by the carved sunbird monoliths, and where the silent populace of the city waited. But when he reached the cleft in the red cliffs that guarded the entrance to the sacred grotto, he unbuckled his sword and handed it to his little pygmy huntmaster. His shield and helmet he gave to his armor-bearers, and bareheaded and unarmed, he entered the opening in the cliff. He passed through the paved tunnel and into the silent beauty of the grotto. The surrounds of the pool were paved with slabs of sandstone, and the pool itself was edged with a rounded coping of the same material. Tiers of stone benches rose against the sheer walls of the grotto, and against a far wall, the shrine of Astarte was built, half into the living rock. Its portals were columned in the Hellenic style, and it contained the cells of the priestesses and the chamber of the oracle. Beyond the stone throne of the oracle was concealed the entrance to the city archives, cut into the rock, and beyond that again, guarded by a massive stone door and the curse of the gods, was the treasury and the tomb of the kings. Lannan paused beside the pool, and the priestesses came forward to meet him and escort him to the edge of the pool. Here they helped him to shed his armor and undergarments. He stood, tall and naked, golden-headed and beautifully formed, at the head of the steps leading down into the green water. His body was finely muscled as that of a trained athlete, although there was heavy bunched muscle on his shoulders and neck, the mark of the swordsman. His belly and flanks, however, were lean, and the shape of muscle beneath the skin but lightly started. A gilding of red-gold hair ran down from his navel across the flat stomach to explode in a sunny burst of curls in the angle of his legs. The legs were shapely, long and molded, and balanced his regal bulk easily. The high priestess blessed him and called down the goddess's favor upon him. Then Lannan went down the steps and immersed himself in the sacred, life-giving water. While two young novices dried his body and dressed the king in robes of fresh linen, Hui Ben Ammon sang the praise chant to the goddess, and when it ended, all eyes looked up to the opening in the roof of the cavern high above the green pool. Lannan called out in a loud voice, "Astarte, mother of moon and earth, receive the messenger we send you, and hear our plea with favor." The throng about the pool lifted their hands high in the sign of the sun, and at the signal, the body of the sacrifice plunged from the slab that jutted into the opening in the grotto roof. The wail of the doomed soul echoed briefly about the cavern until he struck the water and was dragged down swiftly into the green depth by the weight of the chains he wore. Lannan turned from the pool and passed between the ranks of the priestesses into the entrance of the shrine. The audience chamber of the oracle was only a little larger than the living room of a rich man's house. The lamps burned with a steady light. The flames were tinted an unnatural greenish hue, and the incense of burning herbs was heavy and oppressive. There were draperies beyond the oracle's throne hanging from roof to the flagged floor. The oracle sat upon the throne, a small figure, completely swathed in white robes, the face hidden in the shadow of her hood. Lannan halted in the center of the chamber, and before he spoke, he admired for a moment the arrangements that put the interviewer at such a disadvantage. Barefooted, damp from the pool, stripped of weapons and finery, dressed in strange robes, and forced to look up at the figure on the throne while he inhaled the subtly drugged air. He must be off balance. Lannan felt his anger stir, and his voice was harsh as he made the formal greeting and asked the first question. Hui watched from his place of concealment behind the draperies. He reveled in the closeness of his friend's physical presence, remembering his mannerisms and voice tones, watching the familiar and well-loved face, smiling at an unexpected change of expression, the quick smolder of anger in the pale blue eyes, the quickening of interest at a warning, the glimmer of a smile as he recognized good advice. Tanith spoke in the same sing-song cadence as Hui had used, picking the answers from the wide selection with which Hui had armed her. When Lannan was finished and would have left the chamber, Tanith's voice stopped him. "There is more." Lannan turned back with surprise, for he was not accustomed to unsolicited and unpaid-for counsel from the oracle. But Tanith spoke. "The lion had a faithful jackal to warn him of the hunter's approach, but drove the jackal away. The sun had a bird to carry the sacrifices on high, but turned his countenance away from the bird. The hand had an axe to defend it, but cast the axe aside. O proud lion, O faithless son, O careless hand! Behind the drapery, Hui held his breath. It had sounded very clever when he'd composed it, but now, spoken out in the bare stone chamber, it shocked even him. Lannan's pale eyes seemed to glaze over as he puzzled the riddle. But it was not that subtle, and as the import struck him, his eyes cleared to the chill sparkle of sapphire, and the blood engorged his face and neck. "Damn you, witch!" he shouted. "Must I have it from you also? That cursed priest plagues me at every turn. I cannot walk the streets of my city, but I hear the crowd sing his piddling songs. I cannot dine in my own banquet room, but my guests will repeat his empty mouthings. I cannot fight, nor drink a bowl of wine, nor toss a dice, but his shadow stands at my shoulder." Lannan was panting with anger as he stamped across the audience chamber and shook his fist in the oracle's startled face. "My children, even! He bewitches them also!" Behind the drapes, Hui felt his spirits soar on bright wings. This was not an enemy speaking. "He struts and lords it in the streets of my city. His name echoes through my kingdoms." Lannan's anger was changing to righteous indignation. "They cheer him when he passes, I've heard it. And by great Baal, they cheer him louder than they do their own king." Lannan swung away from the throne, unable to control his agitation. His eyes swept over the draperies, and for an instant seemed to stare into Hui's soul. Hui drew back with a quick intake of breath, but Lannan paced quickly about the chamber before approaching the oracle again. "He does all this, mark you, without my favor. He should be an outcaster." He broke off and paced again, and his voice changed, the cutting edge of it dulled, and he said, almost inaudibly, "How I miss that terrible little man." Hui doubted for a moment that the words had been spoken, but almost immediately Lannan's voice rose in a bellow. "But he defied me. He took from me what was mine, and that I cannot overlook." Lannan whirled and stormed from the shrine. His gentleman-at-arms and his huntmaster saw the expression on his face, and they signalled the warnings ahead of the king's furious progress back to the palace. On the final day of the festival, Lannan Hyrcanus prayed in the temple of Great Baal, alone in the sacred grove among the towers and the sunbird monoliths. Then he emerged to receive the renewed pledges of loyalty from his subjects. Each of the 9 noble families would be represented, as well as the order of priesthood, the guilds of craftsmen, and the powerful trading syndicates of the kingdom. They would restate their oaths of allegiance to the throne and present gifts to the Grey Lion. Hui Ben Ammon was absent from the ceremony. Backmore made the oath for the priesthood and presented the gift. Lannan growled softly at the young warrior priest as he made obeisance before him. "Where is the holy father of Ben Ammon?" "My lord, I speak for him and all the priests of Great Baal." Backmore avoided the question as Hui had coached him, and Lannan could protest no further in the presence of his assembled nobles. The ceremony ended the festival, and Opet plunged into an orgy of food and wine and frolic and license. While Lannan feasted with his nobles in the palace, the commoners thronged the narrow streets, singing and dancing. The wine vendors passed freely amongst them. But during the daylight hours, the restraints of custom and law checked the behavior of the crowds. Darkness would bring on the lewd and wanton revels which characterized the festival. In the night, the noble matrons and their pretty daughters would slip out, cloaked and hooded, into the streets to join the debauchery, or at the very least to watch it with shining eyes and breathless laughter. For a day and a night, the rules of society were suspended, and no husband or wife could demand explanation or accounting from their spouses. It happened only once every 5 years, and when the festival ended, there were wine-sore heads, pale faces, shaking hands, as well as smug and secret smiles.